So we're going to be talking about our experiences in sampling soils like this, both on in this area and over here, as well, both in the marsh and in the subaqueous area. And I want to start by thanking my co-author, Mark Stolt. We actually began some of these endeavors together over 25 years ago. And the reason that we've had some success along the way, at least that I have, is that, you know, on the one when we got started, we were a bit naive going into some of these, but we didn't know any better. And we had some people working with us that were creative and innovative and said we could do things that you might never think you could do. And there were ways to accomplish some of the difficulties here. So the issues, of course, we're going to talk both about tidal marsh soils and subaqueous soils. These are the areas that we've been working in for the last 25 years. And the marsh soils, of course, are saturated continuously. They got water tables up near the surface most of the time. The subaqueous soils are actually underwater. And both of these are found, many of them are found in estuarine-type systems, which create mineralogical environments, chemical environments, which create certain problems that need to be dealt with. So collecting, transporting, storing these kinds of materials are really difficult. And there are a lot, we've been doing these kinds of things in subaerial environments forever, for 100 years. And the things that we typically use going in there don't always work, although some of them do, surprisingly. So if you think it's tough to work in an environment like this in terms of sampling soils, imagine what it's like to try to sample your soils out here. We've been working in both of these kinds of environments, and I'll say, I think, reasonably successfully. So as we get started, I want to talk about the collection of soil samples, which is one hurdle that needs to be overcome, and then the storage transport of these materials, because many of them contain things that are highly labile, and if you don't care for them properly, you're going to get some significant alterations in the materials themselves. So I would say, starting out, you want to know something about your system before you begin to sample. Of course, sometimes you don't know much until you get out there, and so there's some trial and error that's involved. But it's helpful if you know something about the physical properties, because that's going to affect the way in which you're going to be able to collect samples. Are they soft, or what we call high-end value? Are they hard? Are they dense? Are they going to have a tendency to flow? And you can get things that are going to flow either because they're high sandy, like John described, or because they're high-end value or high-fluidity materials that will tend to get sucked back out of your sampler. So there's a variety of samples, a variety of sampling issues. And then what are the chemical properties? Because this is going to affect the way that you need to store your samples, particularly if they come from an estuarine system that may have sulfides. That has a huge ramifications on whether or not or what kinds of changes you might expect in the samples. So working in tidal marshes, we're going to cover these briefly. Believe it or not, we're going to talk about excavating a pit in tidal marshes. This is one of the things that never occurred to me that we could do, but I have had some people around me that said this could be done, and we did it. Again, using a bucket auger, there's the most traditional sampling tool around, but sometimes works in some of these systems. And then we'll talk about the Macaulay sampler, vibrocoring. And working in subaqueous environments, we use many of the same tools. Of course, we're not going to be digging any pits in subaqueous environments. But bucket augers, Macaulay samplers, vibrocorers, and also a piston core sampler is another tool that's been used in the coastal geology community for a while, but it is very useful. So, believe it or not, you can do some excavation of tidal marshes in some settings. You know, here's a tidal marsh with emergent vegetation where we could successfully dig a pit, and here's one clearly where we couldn't. So not all tidal marshes are flats or materials are going to lend themselves. But if you get into the high marsh areas that tend to have a good root mat in the upper part, it is passable actually to dig a hole. When we first started doing this, I would say the first one we did was, Mark, what, 85, 84? Somewhere in that region, you know, we envisioned, you know, well, the water is going to be flowing through and over top, and so we're going to have to build dikes, and we were sort of pleasantly surprised that in the high marsh, of course, you don't want to do it when the tide is actually above the soil surface, right? You want to plan it so that you don't have to pump out the universe. But also, the hydraulic conductivity in these materials oftentimes is low enough that it's not that serious a problem, and so. Although we diked the area with these boards that we hammered into the, you know, the upper surface to kind of keep the water out, it didn't really matter. But you do have to have a pump so that as you're digging your way down, You're keeping the water out. This is not that different than holes that you've dug in poorly drained soils. They're just a little bit wetter. And so you have to get the water out of there. It's a continual process, or you pump for a while, get it down. And the real critical thing is to be able to have some young guys to help you do this. This was 25 years ago when Mark and I didn't know any better. And so we were out there working in some of these marshes a long time ago. But we're both kind of old, and we said we're not sure we would do this again. But we'd had some good graduate students that would be able to do this. It's pretty strenuous. This is just another example of another pit for we did on a field trip. We figured out when we're working these high marshes, it's relatively easy. You just need a pump. You don't actually have to cordon it off. And the result is that you can open up some very beautiful soil profiles in marshes. And you can get some beautiful photographs. You can do sampling the way you normally would. You just have to keep your pump operating or turning it on and off periodically to keep the water down. And of course, these were the ideal situation. These are old submerged upland marshes. They had a pretty firm substratum. Although when we got down below a little bit, what you can see, we got into some sands that began to flow. And at that point, you know, then this doesn't work. So there's limitations, but it's at least one approach that can be used. It's fairly traditional, so I thought I'd, and it's a little unconventional, so I thought I'd mention it. Then, of course, the bucket auger. You know, bucket auger is a standard sampling tool for soil scientists. However, you be sure you, when you're working, you generally don't want to use an open bucket. You want to use a closed bucket to kind of keep it protected a little bit. But it can be done, even in subaqueous systems. We can use them in the marsh, but also it's, and one of the nice things about it is it's a tool that everybody has. It's relatively inexpensive, and it's fast. You can just walk out there and start augering, believe it or not. The limitations, of course, are one, that it's usually limited to relatively shallow water. And normally you have to be in the water to do the sampling. Now this varies a little bit, depends on the clarity of the water, but our experience is that most of the work that we've done, you actually have to stand there and have a person who's stationary, so because you have to go back down through the same hole each time, right? So you have to be able to locate the hole. And with the water's a little bit murky, you can't do that unless you're actually standing there in place. As any bucket auger sampling does, there's some poor horizon resolution. You get a little mixing between horizons. That just comes with the territory. And of course, if you get into high end value materials or soft materials, there's a tendency for it to get sucked back out of the auger. Now, we'll show a little innovation that was developed actually about 35 years ago by Bob Darmody to allow you to introduce air under the sample as you're extracting it to kind of break that suction. And then, of course, you don't have any controls on bulk density, so if you're interested in carbon storage pools and things, you can't get it that way. And if you're going to be standing in the water, you're not going to do it in the winter. However, this is an example. Mark tells me that sometimes the water clarity up in where they've been working, some of these ponds in New England, southern New England, they can actually do bucket augering over the side of a boat. They can actually see down to find the hole. But there's certainly some limitations as to how deep you're going to be able to get with this kind of technique. This is the bucket auger modification. This was published in the Soil Science Journal, I think in 76. And basically, there's a stainless steel tube which is soldered down the outside and has a little pore, a hole down here to actually enter. You can use it, auger your way down, and then as you extract the sample, you use the bulb to apply some pressure down through the tube, and it kind of blasts a little, puts air, and introduces a conduit so air can get under the sample. So as you're extracting, it breaks the suction. It's pretty cool. Now, the other tool, one of our tools of choice, is the Macaulay sampler. This was developed actually at the Macaulay Institute in Scotland. It uses a barrel with a vein that you can actually push into the soil and then rotate it a half a turn, and it cuts off what I would call an undisturbed half core, and then you extract that. It usually collects them in 50 centimeter increments, although Mark has one that's been specially built that's a 100 centimeter section, which moves twice as fast. But it's a 2-inch or 5 centimeter half core, and one of the great things is you get really beautiful horizon resolution. As you're looking at these, you can see these breaks and horizons very distinctly. It's easy to sample those and to recognize those to get your depth, and you get no vertical compression with this, because you're inserting the auger and then you're taking your cut. So you don't get some compression that you get with some of the other sampling techniques. And so it's actually very useful for getting bulk density measurements, because you can take a section of this core, which you can calculate the volume and the length, and then sample that, dry it, and get bulk density measurements. So in terms of carbon storage and carbon pool calculations, it's very nice to work with. You can go deep with this. You can get extensions, so you can add, you know, I don't know, like 6 or 10 meters worth of extension handles. There's really no limit, although it gets a little cumbersome. It might take a couple of people to manage the equipment, but you can do it over the side of the boat. This is an example where we did some work out into a marsh, and we took samples down to 4 meters by hand with this. And then this is a transect out into Chincoteague Bay, where we sampled 2.5 meters into the soil in 2.5 meters of water, easily and effectively. And you don't have to go down in the same hole. Now, the limitation, before we go on, this is an example of the auger that Mark had built. It has a 100-centimeter chamber, basically the same. And in freshwater systems, you can actually do some of this sampling in the winter on the ice, and you can avoid the whole boat issue. Most of the estuaries where we worked with the salt water, you don't get good ice forming, so you can't do that. But in the freshwater ponds, you can, if you're sampling the subaqueous soils, sediments at the base of some of these lakes and ponds, this is very nice. Now, it's limited to being able to use only in high-end value or soft materials. I say high-end value greater than 0.7. I've recently concluded that those numbers don't really mean anything. I mean, they're not accurate numbers, but we'll say things that have at least slightly or moderate fluidity, slight or moderate fluidity. Or, of course, if there's some things that are highly fluid, they'll tend to flow out. But for most soil materials that are soft, you push them in. But so if you're dealing with sandy materials or dense materials, you can't use this tool. You also get a relatively small sample size. You know, if a half, you can do the calculations, but a half core that's a 5 centimeters in diameter is going to give you, if you're trying to do analytical work on the materials you're pulling out, sometimes we have to pull out 2 or 3 replicate cores to get enough sample of a given horizon in order to do some of the analytical work that we want to do. And the cost is moderate. I mean, from a research standpoint, $1,000 isn't really very much, but it's a lot. You know, it's about, I don't know, 5 or 10 times the cost of what a bucket auger would be. And IJLCAMP is the Dutch manufacturer that you can buy these. And but Mark got his 100-centimeter auger built in the machine shop, right? Yeah. And that also cost about $1,000 for materials and labor to put that together, right? So. Another tool that's fairly useful is vibrocoring. This technology has been around in the coastal geology community for a long time. You use a vibrating head that looks something like this. This is designed for vibrating the air out of concrete. You know, they're constructing concrete, they pour the concrete, they put in a vibrator with this high frequency vibration. The air floats out, and so it increases the strength of the concrete. That's what the equipment was designed for. But if you take this head and clamp it to a piece of aluminum or polycarbonate, usually aluminum irrigation pipe, you create these real high-frequency vibrations. And as you're putting this down on the soil, those vibrations are passed to the soil material, and it causes it to liquefy in a thin, just millimeters zone right around to the tube, and you can just push the auger right down into the material, even if it's sandy. You have to put some weight on it. Usually we just lean on it, sometimes you have to stand on it. But it's amazing how quickly and easily, and sometimes in, you know, 15 seconds, you push this down a meter or two. I mean, just sometimes you just right in. Things that are sandy, things that you'd never be able to, you know, push a Macaulay sampler through. Now, once it's in, you have to fill the tube if it's not already filled with water, and then plug the top, because you're going to just pull this out, and if you don't plug the top, it's all just going to be sucked out the bottom, right? So the suction forces are great. And it's so hard to pull that you have to attach it to something strong, a tripod, and then use a winch or a chain fall or something to be able to get energy to actually extract it out of the soil. And remarkably, you end up with some very nice cores, very nice samples. Yeah, sometimes you get a little bit that's lost out of the bottom. But they're relatively undisturbed. We'll talk about a little bit more what relatively undisturbed means, but they can be several meters long. They can be used either in soft materials or dense materials, and they can also be stored. You can cap both ends, collect several of these on your vessel, take them back, and because they continue to stay sealed up, they're not oxidizing or changing, as long as you don't let them sit, you know, too long under warm conditions. So they're really a nice tool. But the limitations are it's a little bit slow and cumbersome, at least the setup. You have to, you know, get a platform on the boat or a platform that's not going to move around, so you usually have to put several anchors, three or four anchors off the vessel to kind of keep it stationary as you're working. Now, once you get it set up, you can actually pull the core probably in 10 or 15, 20 minutes. It doesn't take too long, but it's the setup getting that takes a little bit longer to do. The equipment is a little more costly. You have to have a vessel, of course, to get out there, although this is also used in marshes. The coastal geologists have been using this in deep marshes for a long time. You know, a couple thousand dollars maybe for some of the equipment for your tripod and, you know, the vibrating head, that could run you $1,000 or $2,000 depending. Usually we've been using gasoline-powered ones, but there are also electric ones that you could run off a generator that you could take out with you. So there's a lot of options on that. And then one of the other issues that we deal with is what's sometimes called collapse or rot of the cores, that there's essentially some compaction that goes on by the vibrating and the insertion of the core. And to illustrate this, if this is our vibracore from the vessel, you know, we start with an aluminum tube that might extend up higher so we can apply some pressure, but we vibrate it and we push it down into the sediment core, the soil core, we notice that there's a difference in the soil surface here and where the surface is inside the tube. And this is the compaction or the collapse or the rot. And the magnitude of that varies dramatically on the soil. Sometimes it's only a few percent and it's sort of, you know, insignificant. In other cases, you can have up to like 30%. We were pulling some cores this summer up in Rhode Island, and some of those had about a 30% collapse. I was shocked that it was that much. Now, when that happens, then you have to, you know, there's these issues about, you know, how you can you just distribute that, assume that's equally over the whole core? Well, maybe not. It depends. It probably depends a lot on the nature of the horizons. And so you get some difficulty in determining, you know, where the horizon boundaries should exactly be because of the collapse. So there are issues that have to be addressed. But for the most part, it's still very useful. Now, another instrument is the piston sampler. And the piston sampler uses a tube, could be aluminum or it could be polycarbonate, but it has a piston inside. And the instrument is usually lowered down so that it just touches the sediment surface, and then you fix this cable. See, there's a cable attached to this piston that sort of goes out the sampler. And then you fix that cable so that the piston is held stationary while you push the tube down into the material. And what that does is it creates suction above the core so you don't get the collapse and compaction. And so as you're putting it in, it actually sort of sucks from above and keeps the core intact. And then when you extract it, the whole thing comes out. You pull the cable and the sampler up together because you've already got the seal on top. You get some smaller ones here. This is an aluminum one. It's designed, if you buy them commercially, they're fairly expensive, several thousands of dollars probably. But one of the nice things is that this shows, in the case of using this polycarbonate tube, and I ought to say, both with vibracoring and with this device, you can use these polycarbonate tubes, which is really nice because it allows you to see the sediment core right in place. It costs about 10 times the cost of aluminum, roughly. But if you have limited numbers or certain things, you know, it's really nice. And you can see that you get a relatively undisturbed surface. This is a subaqueous soil, which is pretty nice. Now, let's talk a few minutes about sample handling and storage. The physical properties of these materials are generally pretty stable. They're not going to change appreciably. The methodology on determining those may alter a little bit. But we're mainly concerned about chemical changes that occur. And some of the properties and components are highly labile and will change dramatically, in some cases over minutes. And they range across the whole spectrum. Iron monosulfides, for example, are incredibly labile. You pull them out, you can see changes visibly in a matter of minutes to hours. The disulfides, like pyrite, are also fairly labile. You know, both of these are unstable in an oxidizing environment. They only form in these subaqueous or tidal marsh type environments. And they'll change appreciably usually over a period of weeks. The oxidation of the iron monosulfides is chemical and fast. The oxidation of the pyrite is usually driven by microbial processes, and it's a little bit slower. And as these components oxidize, you end up with changes in pH and salinity that go along with those over the same period of time. Things like carbonate content, that may change as pH acidity is generated from acid sulfate weathering. Organic matter, by comparison, is going to not change very much. It's going to be relatively stable. Now, this is an example of some materials that have got the black monosulfides. Iron monosulfides, FeS, is a black, poorly crystalline materials, minerals. Usually we find them only in the surfaces of subaqueous soils because this represents sort of a time sequence. These are older materials as you get deeper. The monosulfides are less stable. The disulfides are thermodynamically favored, and so you get alteration to form things like pyrite deeper. But you get these black colors on the surface. These are this is a soil that was formed from materials that were dredged from Baltimore Harbor. And so it's usually the young sediments where you find these. This shows the same mineral. These are some iris tubes. I couldn't have a talk without iris tubes. And so iris tubes, these we're now using to measure sulfide, pore water sulfide, in tidal marshes. And we put these in, believe it or not, for 5 minutes into a tidal marsh. And this is the magnitude of the iron monosulfide that formed, probably indicating about 10 millimolar sulfide in these marshes. But the point is, you don't usually find iron monosulfides in the marshes. But you pull these tubes out, within a matter of 10 minutes, 15 minutes, they've changed dramatically. When they're exposed to oxidation, those minerals oxidize really quickly. So one way to test whether or not you have iron monosulfides in your samples is to use hydrogen peroxide. This is a test that Mark and his students developed. You pull it out. If it looks black, you know, that black color sometimes is from organic material, sometimes from monosulfides. If you put some hydrogen peroxide, this can be the 3%, you know, the CVS variety, generic, doesn't have to be research grade 30% stuff. And you can see immediately there's a color change there. If you have the monosulfides, it's immediately oxidized and changed by the peroxide, and so it's a quick test whether or not you need to be worrying in these types of materials about this really rapid change. If you don't have the monosulfides, the disulfides are a little more forgiving. You still need some care, though. The pyrite, this is an example of some pyrite framboids that have formed in some marshes. Materials, this is where they look with a scanning micrograph. They're formed in subaqueous soils and marshes. They're oxidized when they're exposed to oxidizing environments by microorganisms over a period of time. The important thing is that the reaction, the oxidation of the sulfide, ends up with the oxidation and the hydrolysis of iron, produces 2 moles of sulfuric acid, which creates significant changes in the properties of the soil. It drives down the pH, and it also reacts with other minerals to produce salts. You get a lot of sulfate salts that are generated, which can affect not only things, measurements like EC, but the way you run particle size. Sometimes you have to deal with removing salts before you can do standard analysis. But this shows a number of samples that were pulled and then incubated moist. One of the ways that we test whether or not we have significant sulfides is to do a moist oxidizing incubation to sort of facilitate the oxidation by microbes of the pyrite. And we can see that many of these drop down. These are weeks. So within 2 weeks, some of these have dropped down to pH below pH 4, and some of these will continue down below pH 3. And so they normally start circumneutral, somewhere around 7, maybe a little higher if there's some small amounts of carbonates present. So the changes in pH are dramatic. And so this is something to watch out for. This shows the difference in salinity that was measured from some samples. This is from Maggie Payne's thesis up in one of Mark's students. These were subaqueous samples that were pulled from a coastal lagoon. And so the blue bars represent the salinity that was originally commanded. You see, most of these are around 30 parts per thousand. These are pretty much near the salinity of seawater. But when the pyrite oxidized, many of these went from about 50 to 100% or over 100% higher. And there's a lot of samples that will have the same amount of pyrite, but maybe come from less saline environments. So they might start out looking something like this, or they might only have almost insignificant salts, maybe a few parts per thousand salinity, and yet they generate the same amount of sulfate salts. So if you're measuring EC, you know, the change is huge. You know, 1,000% increase in some of these in terms of the salts that are generated. And of course, this also, as I mentioned, if you're doing particle size analysis on samples that have been stored in this kind of an environment, you need to do some kind of a dialysis step to remove the salts before you do dispersion, other things you would normally do. So how do we deal with these problems? Most of these problems are related to either chemical or microbiological changes that are driven by the oxidation. And therefore, the general sort of the ways that we approach this are really twofold. We want to either slow down the chemical reactions or protect against the exposure to oxygen. Okay, pretty simple, or usually we do both. So slowing down, basically we do this by cooling the samples, chilling the samples. At a bare minimum, you can always have a cooler with ice in it, right? We know that everyone always has a cooler with ice in it when they're out working on these vessels, but you probably want a different cooler to pour your samples in. But this will help. Immediately it chills the sample, slows down the activity. But the preferred way, if you're really concerned about the potential oxidation, is to first sparge with nitrogen. We'll commonly take a small nitrogen tank out, and we'll sparge several times to replace the oxygen in the atmosphere and seal that off. Should be aware that most polyethylene bags will, over time, allow a small amount of oxygen to diffuse through them, and so that, you know, if you get a heavier grade, that'll be better. And then you can either store on ice in the field, or preferably even freeze them. You know, we've taken dry ice out. For certain cases where we knew we had a lot of monosulfides and the potential for change quickly, we actually took liquid nitrogen out into the field. This also is a bit cumbersome to haul these Dewar flasks out into the field with you. But if you're concerned about some of these changes, they need to be done. And then you want to freeze them until you actually analyze them. Then under extreme cases, especially if you're dealing with soils that have monosulfides in them, you may need to actually work in a nitrogen atmosphere in a glove bag. But for most cases, most marsh samples, for example, don't have a lot of monosulfides in them. And so you can probably get by just working quickly in an anaerobic, under an oxidizing environment, because we're talking about sort of days to weeks to get the pyrite oxidized. Now, so that's sort of a long time, right? Well, we're used to drying things, letting them sitting around for weeks or months before we get around to analyzing. And so it's a very different scenario. You need to keep things cold, frozen, pull them out just before you're ready to do the analysis. So to summarize, we would say that working in these kinds of environments is challenging, and it requires some special approaches to doing things. But at the same time, it is possible, it can be done, and it's usually fun. At least it seems fun the first time you do it. So these are some examples of a number of sampling events and adventures that we've been on over the last 25 years with some of the folks. And so with that, I will say thank you, and if there's any time, I'll be glad to answer any questions. Okay.